Welcome to Dr. Hustle, the podcast where we interview physicians and health professionals who are living at the crossroads of innovation as leaders, entrepreneurs, and artists. Our mission is to showcase the insights and skills that can help you discover the creative and leadership potential within yourself. Here's your host, Bassam Zahid.
Hey listeners, my name is Bassam Zahid, and welcome to episode 9. What did you eat last night for dinner? And what are you eating tomorrow morning for breakfast? Do you know? In a world where we seem to only be getting busier, our next guest advocates that more planning, not less, is the key to living healthier and longer lives. Dr. Timothy Harlan became a restaurant manager at 18, a restaurant owner at 22. Then he decided, why not? Let me try my hand at medicine. Starting as a medical student, Dr. Harlan has written numerous books and articles on healthier eating and wellness. His 2002 public broadcast program, The Dr. Gourmet Show, earned an Emmy Award for Excellence in Medical Programming. More recently, Dr. Harlan works as the Associate Dean for Clinical Services at Tulane University School of Medicine and serves as Executive Director of the Goldring Center for Culinary Medicine, the first of its kind teaching kitchen in New Orleans, Louisiana. For over 20 years, Dr. Harlan has been inspiring patients to upgrade their diet, to start exercising, and to take a long-term approach to improving their health. So get ready for class, kids. The doctor is in. So, Dr. Harlan, welcome to the podcast.
Great to be with you. How are you today?
I'm doing great. I want to start somewhere at the beginning of your life. One of the things you did in your book, you kind of dedicated your book to your mom. And one of the things you said about her was that you and your brother would often think, you know, what would Kate do? Right? And at the same time, she apparently had a big influence in how you started cooking. She would let you help out around the house.
Yeah. Well, you know, that's interesting. It's the first time anybody's in an interview has asked about my mom or I think actually read the book. So that's pretty cool. My mom was an interesting person. You know, she grew up, she was, you know, clearly a product of the Depression. She was born in the late 20s and, you know, lived through the Depression and into the war. And my mother and father married very young. She had gone to Duke at 15. So she went to college when she was 15 and actually was expelled because she and my father eloped. And so they started a family pretty young and had five kids. I was the fifth. I was born in 58. I'm kind of the tail end of the baby boomers. And that period in the 60s, I think, you know, was a revelatory time for women. And when I turned eight, my mother went back to college. And I think she went back partly because her kids were getting older and she wanted to finish. And she ended up taking a doctorate in psychology and practiced. She was a clinical psychologist for 45 years. And I think was literally, she passed away this year. She was still seeing patients up until about 3 weeks before she died. And, you know, I think that's a really great example for any kid to see their parent transform themselves like that. But at the same time, you know, I started learning to cook in many ways out of self-defense. You know, my mother was really busy. She was, working on school and her dissertation and so I started cooking. The other thing is we didn't have a lot of money. And so kind of that traditional, you know, maybe there's snacks around the house, wasn't there, but I could cook with any ingredients. So I could cook with the potatoes or the flour, you know, and, or the sugar. So I learned to make taffy, you know, I made my own candy when I was about nine and, you know, the joy of cooking was there and I learned, you know, I didn't have a candy thermometer. So, you know, I learned all about crackball stage and how to make candy from scratch, just out of sugar and water, basically. You know, I think it just was, you know, a moment in American history in many ways where women were going from being stay-at-home moms, which my mother was for most of her life, to working. And I kind of hit that cusp moment, and I just learned to cook.
So her example was obviously influential for you because you yourself started working at 11, right? You started...
Yeah. You know, I think there were a number of things. First of all, you know, the world was very different, obviously, you know, 50 years ago in the 60s. And in the South, and I assume across much of the country, working at 10 or 11 or 12 was not all that unusual. I mean, kids literally had paper routes. You know, my brother mowed lawns. And again, my father sold textile machinery and he traveled. And, you know, I think he, you know, made a pretty solid middle class living. But at the same time, you know, there were five kids and four boys and we were hungry. And, you know, those expenses, I think, were challenging for them to meet. And so, you know, my allowance, I think, was a quarter. Which was, you know, more money then than it is now. But, and so if we wanted money, we went out and earned money somehow, either by, as I said, you know, mowing lawns, et cetera. And I started washing dishes. Atlanta was a boom city in the late 60s and early 70s, and restaurants were opening all over, left and right. And again, it was a very different time for food. That's the interesting thing. Like, we didn't have fresh mushrooms, and not because, you know, we couldn't afford fresh mushrooms necessarily. They just didn't exist. I mean, you know, the palette of ingredients that we take for granted today just weren't there. And so, you know, a lot of the restaurants that were opening were some of them really innovative or unusual cuisine. And I went to work in this steakhouse and I started there and I started washing dishes. I think my mother also knew, you know, I was the fourth of four boys and certainly my brothers had misbehaved some. And by the time I was 11, I think she just felt like she knew where I was going to be on Friday and Saturday nights. And I quickly moved into bussing tables in a really nice fine dining restaurant with a very charming waiter by the name of Kurt, who taught me to eat mushrooms, actually. You know, they did, this was really old style Gueridon service, you know, table side service where they would make your Caesar salad and carve the Chateaubriand table side. And all the waiters were tuxedoed, you know, the old fashioned captaincy system where Kurt was the only person on the team. There was a waiter, two back waiters, and a busboy. He was the only person allowed to talk to the customers. Nobody else could talk, you know, you couldn't talk to the customers. So, you know, I just kind of was around food and had an appreciation of food from a very young age. My father was also a really keen cook. I think he liked to cook a great deal. But, you know, it was interesting. I mean, I grew up in Atlanta, Georgia, and in the South. You know, in 1968, bagels were a real novelty. I mean, I remember the first bagel bakery that opened. It was a real novelty. So, I don't know. I also was lucky enough, I think, to grow up at a time where food was becoming more than just sustenance.
Right. Okay, so two questions before we move on to this. Okay. One, what was the one meal that your mom used to make that, you know, kind of hit home for you? Like, it... You know, like the kind of meal that you still dream about.
Well, that's a great question. My mom made amazing fried chicken. And you know, I don't not eat fried chicken because, I think fried food is okay occasionally. And certainly millions of people grew up in the 20s, 30s, 40s and 50s eating fried chicken and fried foods regularly. And didn't have problems with their weight or obesity or their health. So I think it can be part of a balanced and good diet. But she, it's actually probably the first place I noticed herbs. So my mother would make fried chicken kind of the way you do it in the South. You take cut up chicken, you pat it dry, you take a brown paper sack and you put flour and herbs in it. And usually herbs meant salt and pepper. I mean, that's what went in. But my mother used rosemary and a little bit of thyme in her chicken, dried rosemary and thyme. And it was the first time I think I recognized what small flavors could do. Because I'm just going to tell you, you know, her fried chicken was amazing, and she fried it in this, you know, kind of countertop. Everybody had a countertop deep fat fryer, you know, about maybe 12 inches in diameter. It was just part of the culture, I think. So yeah, I'd say my mom's fried chicken was pretty amazing. And I don't, and the tragedy is I actually was diagnosed about 6 or 7 years ago with celiac disease. So I almost never eat fried food anymore, because, you know, nobody fries at home, because it's so messy, I guess. And it's a lot of hassle, partly the health issues, I think, but, and so getting, you know, fried chicken out is a real, or for any kind of fried food is a real anomaly for me now.
Okay. And you said before that in the 20s, 30s, and 40s, fried chicken used to be part of people's diets more regularly. Do you think that's...
Oh, yeah.
Do you think that's just because they were more active?
Yeah, I think so. I really think the obesity issue doesn't have to do with fried chicken or skin on your chicken. You know, I think a lot of the things that have been taught for, you know, and a quote, nutrition, end quote, you know, are real misnomers. You know, the reason that I believe that we have such an obese society and a problem with obesity has to do with the easy access to calorie dense and nutrient poor food in large portions that's relatively inexpensive. And it's just easier to eat now. Going out for people in the 50s and 60s was unusual. I mean, we didn't go out to eat. And I think that was the norm. There just weren't that many restaurants. Most of the chain restaurants today that you think of, like Applebee's and Chili's, you know, what's called fast casual, it didn't exist. I mean, fast food barely existed. You know, I remember the first time a McDonald's got built in Atlanta. It was a big deal. And so I just think people ate at home more. And I just think people were much more family-centric. Mom stayed at home more. And there are a lot of factors in that, not just whether it's fried food or not. I just think there were a lot of factors in people eating at home and cooking from ingredients rather than out of a box. Right. Again, I can kind of remember, you know, Shake and Bake and Hamburger Helper. These were, you know, pretty novel concepts in the 60s and 70s, and people just didn't use them as much.
So why do you think we went away from that? Part of me thinks, you know, nowadays society, there's such a drive to be productive, to be busy, that people just end up coming home and they often don't have time to even put anything together.
I don't know. You know, I think that there's no single issue or no single answer to that question. Obviously, it's as we like to say. You know, I'm an internist. It's multifactorial. I think that it's there's a lot of reasons for it. Yes, we're more busy. Yes, we don't have stay-at-home moms, and you know, and yet, you know, generally speaking, women are still, for the most part, the gatekeepers of the kitchen in America, but most of them now work, and so, you know, raising kids is tough, and raising as a mom, I think, I really do think there's, you know, still some very large disparities in how division of labor happens. At least that's what I hear from my patients. I don't have children, so I can't say firsthand, but, you know, my patients relate to me, you know, the challenges that they have as young mothers. And I don't think that their husbands have the, generally speaking, not universally, but, you know, I don't think their husbands have the same or feel the same pressures or challenges and maybe don't pitch in necessarily as much. So, you know, it takes planning. This is really what we teach in our programming, certainly in our community programming, in many ways, what we're doing is just home economics for the 21st century. Mm-hmm. You know, how to read a recipe, parse the recipe, build a weekly menu, build a shopping list to go with that menu, building it in such a way that you're creating leftovers. I mean, we always had leftovers. I think my mom probably, even though she was, you know, for a good portion of my family's life, a stay-at-home mom and taking care of her kids, you know, I think she probably only cooked, you know, four nights a week, and we had leftovers or some other fairly simple dishes, et cetera. So I think there's a lot of reasons. The main reason, you know, again, is because we don't plan. Most people, I do it with patients all the time. I did it on Thursday with a patient, you know, an executive, really super nice guy, at the top of his game, mid-50s, has a problem with his weight all of a sudden, in a way, because, you know, he's become successful and busy. And I say, you know, and I ask people, you know, what are you doing? I mention this in the book. What are you doing at 9 o'clock tomorrow morning? And, you know, people will pull out their iPhone these days and they'll look and they'll tell me, and, you know, what are you doing next Tuesday at 6 p.m.? Oh, you know, I'm picking up the kids from ballet. And I ask them three or four questions, and then I'll say, what are you having for lunch today? And nobody can tell me. Like, I mean, it's you know, occasionally people will say, oh, yeah, I brought my lunch. But that's the exception to the rule. And so, you know, I get up and I think it's about that level of planning, about knowing and taking care of yourself by fueling yourself right, but also fueling yourself with great food, you know, mm-hmm. and making it a bit of an adventure. I take a sandwich for lunch every day, and I've been doing that for decades now. When I was in residency, like you are, we would have long call back then. It'd be 36 hours in the hospital. And I'd take four meals with me. I'd, you know, make them up, pack them up, go find a refrigerator somewhere that I could hide them so no one would
eat right,
my food, make it look unappealing. And I would get up after the long call night before morning report. And, you know, I tried to keep as much of a normal life as possible. So I'd get up, take a shower, shave, put on some real clothes because scrubs are stupid.
That's my life.
Well, you know, I'm 6'4", so a one size fits all clothing in general doesn't work for me, but they're also just dumb. And I don't think terribly professional. That's Tim's opinion. But, you know, and then I'd have breakfast and then I'd go to morning report. And so I think that type of planning and that type of care for yourself is important. And, you know, I take great sandwiches. I make it a little adventure every morning. I have this, you know, I call it a sandwich construction kit, you know, it's on my website, and I teach patients, you know, get yourself four or five spreads that you like, and, you know, hard-boiled eggs or tuna or Swiss cheese or provolone, and here's some veggies and, you know, and some avocado, but make it so that every day is a little different. Mm-hmm. I just think it's partly about embracing that food as adventure. I'm sorry, I've sort of gone off topic.
No, this is great. I like hearing it. And kind of going back to this whole sandwich idea, the sheer number of combinations of sandwiches that you can make just with just a few simple ingredients, right? It's like kind of like the number of permutations of
yeah. I mean, if you've got again, like you know, tuna, you know, a can of tuna and some provolone cheese and hard boiled eggs. And maybe some leftover roast chicken in your house. And, you know, then you've got some maybe cucumbers or, you know, some sort of veggie, some greens, whether that's sprouts or lettuce or spinach, and then mustard or mayonnaise or I use this great Chipotle spread. Mm-hmm. It comes in a little tube called Olo's. It's fantastic. Avocados. And you're right. You can do it. Never make the same sandwich twice.
And then the other thing I wanted to ask you about, because you just mentioned the importance of planning. And I think a lot of people would agree with you. Now, the other thing is there's a, you know, the idea of decision fatigue. Like if someone's making so many decisions in a day, then at some point they kind of lose, their willpower starts to decrease on the back end, right? There's like a somewhat famous story about how President Obama, he never chose what he wore or what he ate every day because he kind of was like, these are decisions that I just can't handle. And now while we aren't making decisions like the president is every day, where do you think?
I don't know. I've never heard that story about President Obama before, and I have a lot of respect for him. But, geez, if you can't make a decision, you know, if fatiguing, if making a decision about what you're putting on is fatiguing, geez, boy, that's a little concerning. You know, I'll flip that around and say I think it's actually that level of planning is more liberating than fatiguing, because if you know what you're doing for dinner tonight, if you know what you're doing for dinner, you know, if you have a pretty good idea of it for next Tuesday, then you can worry. You don't have to worry about it. You know, it's like and I think, you know, I ask patients all the time, and when I'm giving lectures and talking to people, everybody, I think not everybody, but most folks in America, they get home. You're right. They get home. They've not made a decision about dinner, and they feel fatigued by that. And they're standing at the refrigerator, staring into the refrigerator that doesn't have enough ingredients in it for them to make something that they really want. And they're trying to make a decision about it, and they just give up and call Domino's. Mm-hmm. Right. And so I would say the opposite. To me, I try and encourage people that, you know, this should be part of the joy of your life, that I'm going to get to go home tonight and have some bolognese, right? Mm-hmm. And making a spaghetti bolognese, a spag bol, is, you know, is easy. It's not that hard. It takes about maybe 5 minutes to chop the onions and peppers and the garlic, and the rest goes in the pan, and you throw in a little bit of beef and some canned tomatoes, and it simmers while you're changing clothes or exercising, and you come back and you boil some pasta, and boom, it doesn't take that long. I mean, it's 20 minutes. So I would say just the opposite. I think that part of the decision fatigue is that by not planning in advance, you're really setting yourself up for having to make more decisions at a time when it's harder to make them.
Right. When you're hungry, especially.
Yeah. And you know, and then possibly, you know, the biggest problem is you also, you know, I think with that easy access to, you know, calorie dense, nutrient poor food, you know, you do end up maybe, say, at a Whole Foods or a Fairway, you know, because you know, most markets these days have these hot bars, and, you know, I mean, you don't even want to know how many calories are in that food. It's just absurd how it's cooked, and it's not really cooked with a lot of care or thought for anything, really not flavor either, I think. And so you even if you do make that decision late and you go to the grocery store, there's a lot of inertia in saying, well, you know, I'll just grab this, you know, big slab of lasagna. Because, mm-hmm. you know, making lasagna is not easy. I mean, it does take some work. But if you take, you know, an hour or so or 45 minutes on a Sunday to make a huge sheet of lasagna, depending on the size of your family, then you have it for maybe lunch one day and dinner another night. So it's right. It really is just about thinking it through in advance. And most of us are not terribly good planners. You know, physicians, generally speaking, have what my psychology colleagues call a high consideration of future consequences. Mm-hmm. We're very future oriented, right? And so it may be a little easier for us to think about this, you know, the consequences of not exercising, the consequences of not eating healthy. But, you know, most of us don't. Mm-hmm. Most of us actually are very much thinking in the present. And I think that some of what I try and do with my patients in the motivational interviewing piece, in spending time counseling them, working on lifestyle with them, is really about trying to get them, A, to be more future thinking, but also B, to understand that that planning actually makes their lives a lot easier.
Mm-hmm. Okay. There's so much I want to talk about when it comes to like the psychology of food and eating, but I do also want to cover your story, which I think is pretty fascinating. As you worked your way up through the restaurant business, at 18, you became the manager of a restaurant.
Yeah, I started managing. I managed this little healthy fast food restaurant in Atlanta and was pretty successful at it. And the chain was a small privately held company. They had about 20 stores across the country in malls. It was at the beginning of the frozen yogurt craze, when Dannon actually was the number one supplier of frozen yogurt. And you know, the shop made healthy muffins and salads and baked potatoes and, you know, pretty really great salad bar. And I ended up fairly quickly troubleshooting restaurants for this chap, kind of chasing all over the country, helping the restaurants. And I did that for about 3 or 4 years and made a little bit of money and then opened my own restaurant, a little French bistro in Athens, Georgia. You know, sort of, again, modeled in many ways. This is about 79, I guess. 1980, I suppose, something like that. And, you know, kind of modeled on, you know, Julia Child and, you know, the pioneers at the time, the people that, you know, I learned to cook from were, you know, James Beard, Julia Child, Graham Kerr, the Galloping Gourmet. You know, Gourmet Magazine was a real thing. I mean, it was an exotic magazine, and so most of it was self-taught, and I had, you know, I had the operational experience, I think, and we ran a really nice little restaurant. It was a chalkboard menu. Generally speaking, three appetizers, two soups, two salads, and four entrees, and a couple, three desserts. And it changed constantly. I would go to the market every morning and buy ingredients that looked appealing and looked fresh. And this was, you know, sort of at that cusp of you know, nouvelle cuisine. And we kind of straddled that piece. I think we were much more French bistro, country French style food than what I now call New American food. And the restaurant was successful, I think, critically, but not terribly successful financially. Partly because I came to recognize that I was not a very good business person. I'm a pretty good operations guy, and I closed the restaurant to go back to college. And at the time, Georgia State University in Atlanta, I moved back to Atlanta, had a hospitality program that was fairly well thought of. And I started at Georgia State. I actually was I was assistant general manager of a bakery. Vie de France, the people who brought croissants to America, had a wholesale bakery in Atlanta where they made baguettes and croissants. And I managed that during the day, helped manage that during the day, and at night went to school. And at the time, my then wife was facing a lot of health problems. She'd been diabetic. She was juvenile diabetic. And was looking at her first kidney transplant, was on peritoneal dialysis at the time. And I was just around doctors. And, you know, it's a really terrible business, I mean, from a service standpoint. And I thought, golly, I can do a better job than these yahoos. And I ended up in med school. And I don't think I'd do a better job than those yahoos, actually, because the service part of our business is, you know, we're just not, it's not very well set up to be customer friendly, unfortunately. And I think it's going to be a long time. That's changing, but I think it's going to be a while before it is. It's just, I think, a really challenging way to make a living from that standpoint. It's a joyous way to make a living, but I think, you know, to do the type of customer service that I would like to see, is, you know, as an internist or family medicine doc or cardiologist is, you know, or ER doc. It's just really tough because, you know, just for a whole host of different reasons. I think, so that's how I ended up in med school.
Okay. What I find still remarkable about you is that, so you talked about seeing your mom go to college, but then 18, instead of doing the traditional route, you went to work again.
I did. I liked work. I think I was smart enough to know that I wasn't going to do well in college at the time. I went to a boarding school actually for about 3 or 4 years and got a pretty good high school education, I think. But I just think I knew I wasn't ready for college. And I did. And actually, I'm not sure I thought I would ever go to college. I had, and maybe that just is part and parcel of me working so much as a teenager, you know, that I just worked, and that's what I thought one did, I suppose, is my best way to put it.
Yeah.
Maybe it was that example that, and my father actually never finished college. He was incredibly successful as an engineer and a salesman and held a number of patents in the textile machinery business and ended up being quite successful financially. So I think it just wasn't something that I thought of. I will also say that probably in the mid 70s, going to college wasn't necessarily what you did. Mm-hmm. You know, people didn't automatically, they didn't start getting prepared for college as a fourth grader, like happens today. You know, I have these two delightful nieces. I mean, brilliant, brilliant girls, my brother's children. And, you know, I think they were always, you know, they grew up destined to go to college. And I just don't think that was as prevalent then.
And then the other question is about the restaurant you started, which, I mean, there's like a flavor of entrepreneurship in you. How do you think that provided an education for you that helped you in your medical career?
Oh, that's a great question. You are good at this. First of all, I will say, you know, being in the restaurant business, at least in the back of the house, is very much like working in an emergency room. You know, there is a, you know, certainly it's not necessarily life and death, but there is an incredible time pressure, and a peak and flow. You know that Saturday nights are going to be, generally speaking, pretty terrible, both in the restaurant business and in the emergency room. I guess if anything else, you know, one of the things that the restaurant business teaches you is, whether it's front of the house or back of the house, is people who I think are really good at it. And I'm not going to say that I was really good at it necessarily, but I think that people who are really good at it are able to multitask well, and they're able to focus on a multitude of different things. You know, if you're working a saute line, you might have 3 or 4 or 5 pans on the range at the same time, and you know, you have to coordinate that with the guy to your right who's doing grill, and the person on your left maybe who's running the salad station, because everything has to come out at the same time. Mm-hmm. Right? If you got a table of four, you know, or or even worse, you know, a 6-top or an 8-top, you know, you have to deliver the chicken and the duck and the salad, you know, the dinner salad, if you will. You know, you have to deliver all of those at the same time to a waiter or a waitress who's going to have to be there to pick it up at the right time. And depending on the size of the restaurant, you know, that's just a very complex dance. Mm-hmm. And I think that's probably one way that it's helped me in medicine, if anything. I think the other thing is, you know, just being able to work together with people in that way is smart. You know, it's not unlike being in the operating room or the emergency room where, you know, you're, you know, maybe the, what I do today, I only do ambulatory medicine today, and I'm pretty, you know, self-sufficient, and I, you know, see patients in a, in an exam room, and I go from one patient to the next. And so it's probably not as much that way, but certainly for you or for a lot of those of us who practice medicine, it is very much a team sport. Mm-hmm. You know? And being in the restaurant business is absolutely a team sport.
And then the other thing I was thinking about was, you started writing your first books in medical school.
I wrote a small book for a company, a publishing firm in Atlanta that does patient education materials called Pritchett & Hull. Sue Pritchett and Nancy Hull started this company in the early 70s and really were state of the art as far as patient education materials. And it was, so it's a small book that actually did really well, sold and is in print today still.
It's called It's Hartley Fair, right?
It's called It's Hartley Fair, and it's really not a cookbook. It's more of a food manual for patients with cardiovascular disease. You know, and this was a time when, you know, we told people to eat margarine. I think, you know, the bad old days of nutrition. But nobody was talking about food, and I had changed my cooking style, partly because I was healthier and partly because of my wife. And I was used to writing down recipes. You know, I was used to taking a lot of notes and keeping, you know, logs and writing down recipes. And this is actually another sort of cusp moment, maybe. It actually was right at the time that the Macintosh came out. And, you know, that's probably the... You know, I owe most of my life to Steve Jobs, you know, I tried to use an IBM PC, and it was just the dumbest thing. You know, they had these disks and they had this C prompt thing, and you had to know, it was almost like you had to know how to code to be able to use the computer. And I had no patience for it. My brother-in-law tried to teach me how to use an IBM PC, and I just never got it. Right. And I sat down in front of a Macintosh, actually at the VA. The VA had this this computer lab. I was doing some research with a guy on protein chemistry, on alpha-1 antitrypsin, actually. So while I was in college, I had a work-study program, and I was a lab rat for a couple of years. And we were writing a paper together, and this guy is Professor Chawla. He was a great guy. He said, you know, go out and write this up for me, type this up for me. I didn't even know how to type. And I turned on the Macintosh, and I was like, I just instantly understood it. I just instantly got it. And I scraped together some money, actually, and these folks gave me some advance, and I taught myself to type. Bought a Macintosh, taught myself to type, and I wrote this book in my first year of medical school. And I'm very proud of that book. You know, sometimes it's a small, again, it's patient education materials. It's probably, I think it's about 80 pages long. Very simple. You know, I learned a lot from Sue and Nancy about communicating with patients, you know, you know, how to keep it fairly basic. You know, most of those types of materials are written at the sixth or seventh grade reading level. And that's hard to do. You know, I think if you're in medical school, cause you know, you've gone through college and you have a college degree, and you do have to really think about that communication piece. And it's funny, we revise that book every now and again, and to keep it current. And every time I go back, I'm actually really, you know, it seems like this sort of innocuous little, you know, thing that's not really a book, mm-hmm. per se, but it's really, I think, pretty good, and I'm very proud of it.
I mean, on some level, it was like your first foray into public media, right? Because you're finally reaching out to people beyond your patients.
Well, yeah. And you know, that's sort of how Dr. Gourmet got, you know, evolved. Part of it was my brother. He is in the television business, and we had talked about, you know, doing television. And at one point in time, I, you know, wanted to be the Galloping Gourmet, you know, and we did television together and have and some work that I'm really proud of. And I spent a lot of time traveling around the country and, you know, being on this talk show or that talk show. And during that period, and then the next thing that happened was the internet happened. And so, you know, it was really easy to create drgourmet.com. And, you know, Benjamin Franklin said, you know, the power of the press belonged to those who own one.
Right.
And, you know, the fact that you now, 40 years on, actually not even that, I guess, what, 30 years on mm-hmm. from the Macintosh, can do this podcast. Right. It, you know, that's amazing to me. And so, I started writing every day. I mean, I just got into this rhythm, and created the newsletter, the drgourmet.com newsletter. And, you know, I still send it out. You know, it's 5 days a week. We have hundreds of thousands of people who follow that. And you just get into a rhythm of cooking and writing and recipes and thinking about food and, thinking about food and health and trying to share that knowledge. And it's amazing because I started drgourmet.com in 1998. So it's really been going pretty solidly for 20 years. And there are days where my wife is the webmaster. When we met, in the early part of the century, she was the webmaster for the Association of American Medical Colleges. And, for a couple, 3 years while we were dating, she had that job. And then finally I said, why don't you come to work for me? Mm-hmm. And she has been managing that project now for about 15 years. And I think, you know, there's times where both of us think, you know, she'll say, gee, I'm going to stop this and go back and get a real job, and we'll get sick of it, you know, cause it is, it's like this, you know, you just have to feed the beast every
right,
day.
Right.
And then we'll get this email from somebody that says, oh, I read your newsletter every day. I've lost 86 pounds.
Right.
Others are like, damn it.
Yes.
We can't stop now.
Yeah. People need it.
And yeah, you know, so that feedback is always, I mean, that's really more than anything else what keeps that going, because, you know, you feel like, okay, you've reached a large, you know, I can treat one person in the exam room, right, at a time. Mm-hmm. And that's a tremendous joy. I love practicing medicine. But the thought that you may touch 10,000 people in a day who've read your newsletter, that's just a very fun and very cool thing.
And continuing on in your writing career, eventually you wrote a book called Just Tell Me What to Eat. I think it came out in 2011.
Yeah, 2011. Yeah, I think that's book number. So we do some publications ourselves. I did a book in the UK in about 2004, published a book there, and came close, actually, to moving to England at the time. And then between that, I wrote a couple of books for niche diets, for Coumadin users, for patients with acid reflux, which are still in print today. And then Just Tell Me What to Eat was the last trade publication that I wrote. Yeah.
One of the things the book kind of focuses on is like the Mediterranean diet.
That is everything that Dr. Gourmet does and that we do in that I've done in helping in creating this culinary medicine courseware and this culinary medicine programming. So, you know, for 15 years or so, I have been taking Mediterranean diet principles and translating those for the American kitchen. Mm-hmm. You know, when most people think of Mediterranean diet, they think of hummus. I actually had a conversation with somebody yesterday, a consultant who was asking about some work for another nonprofit that I know, and that focuses on Mediterranean diet. And, you know, it's funny because in lectures I'll say, you know, what do you think? You know, I've been talking about Mediterranean diet for 5 minutes and, you know, most of you are thinking olive oil or hummus or feta cheese, mm-hmm. you know, red wine, et cetera. And he actually named all of those things. So most people think of it as Mediterranean recipes, but it's actually these nine principles or nine basic ingredients that you can improve, small incremental improvements that can have a really profound effect on your health, irrespective of weight loss. And those are more vegetables, more legumes. We love legumes, more fruits and nuts, more whole grains, more fish, but less fish than you think, better quality oils and fats, less dairy, and more fermented and processed dairy, less meat and leaner meat, and alcohol in moderation. I think I got all of them. And so those nine principles, when you look at the preponderance of the literature and most of the literature that we have on really good quality literature, it focuses on Mediterranean diet and its impact. So part of the reason that I use that literature and it's become the foundation of Dr. Gourmet as well as the Health Meets Food courseware that I created is because it helps us meet our patients where they live. It helps mm-hmm. you don't have to stop eating meat. Now, if you eat less land animal protein, yeah, you'll be healthier. There's no doubt. If you eat none, I don't think there's evidence that says that's necessarily a lot more beneficial for you. Yeah, maybe a little bit. Certainly, if you eat more fish, that is clearly more beneficial. So, but most of our patients, I think if they come in and sit down and a lot of physicians do this, they offer them, you know, I know an oncologist, a surgical oncologist, who, you know, is touting, you know, gluten-free, full-on vegan. Mm-hmm. It's just not sustainable for most people. And I don't want to criticize it. People want to eat gluten-free and vegan and they like doing that and they enjoy it. That's cool. But you're not necessarily going to be healthier than if you follow a Mediterranean diet. And so it allows us to meet patients where they live. But the book is also about planning.
That's true.
I mean, to me, that's the real theme of the book. Yes, it uses Mediterranean diet principles, but Just Tell Me What to Eat was conceived because patients would come in and they needed that guidance about the planning piece. And so it takes people through a 6-week meal plan that helps them A, understand Mediterranean diet, B, understand how to do the planning, and C, by the time they get through that 6 weeks, they've done most all of the techniques that they need to know and understand, culinary techniques that they need to know and understand to then do this on their own. So that's the real theme of the book, I think.
And one thing I kind of got from it was that it's less.
I'm still amazed that you read it.
I had to find it in like a library, but I got it.
Yeah, I'm still amazed sometimes that people come in with that book. You know, new patients come in and they're holding the book. I'm like, oh, that's kind of cool. Anyway, I'm sorry, I digress.
No, that's cool. So one of the things I feel like I also got from it is it's less of a diet, like people sometimes use the word diet as something that comes and goes, but more of a lifestyle. And it's one of those books that you could come back to multiple times. Like, I mean, you could probably go through it like once a year, just like anything to remind yourself or practice again the principles.
Yeah, I'm fairly proud of that book in that respect. I think that it's the idea is, you know, is not about dieting. It really is about eating great food that just happens to be great for you. You know, there's no reason that you shouldn't be eating macaroni and cheese. You know, okay. I mean, we love mac and cheese. Yeah. It's mac and cheese and spaghetti and tacos. And I mean, there's no reason you shouldn't be eating these things. You know, and there are ways to cook them that are not, you know, radical differences. It's not like, you know, you have to use tofu or seitan or, you know, things that people are not familiar with. You can, you know, use less meat in your tacos, more veggies, the corn tortillas instead of flour tortillas. Nobody should ever eat flour tortillas. They're just white bread basically. Yeah. And, you know, but corn tortillas are a whole grain. They're, you know, and they've got a lot of fiber and they're really good. So it's about making those ingredient selections, as much as anything else, I think. But it just is good food, I think, that happens to be good for you.
Yeah. And so kind of continuing in your career, I kind of want to jump ahead. You kind of through your books and the things you've done, you're very much also an educator.
Yeah, that sort of happened by accident. I had been in private practice and I came back into academic medicine. I moved to New Orleans after Katrina to be part of New Orleans after Hurricane Katrina. And the people at Tulane University, the School of Medicine, were amazing and welcomed me really very much with open arms. And so during that process, our dean at the time, a fellow by the name of Ben Sachs, really brilliant guy, he said he wanted to build a teaching kitchen to teach medical students how to cook. And, you know, one thing has led to another, and we actually ended up building that kitchen and putting it out in the community where we also teach the community how to cook. And I've created, you know, a very robust courseware set for medical students, nursing students, physicians in practice, residents, and the community that we use here in New Orleans, but also is now used by about 40 medical schools and about a dozen residency programs across the country.
And it's called the Gold Ring Center for Culinary Medicine.
Yeah, the courseware is called Health Meets Food. Okay. The center here is the Gold Ring Center for Culinary Medicine, but, you know, schools across the country, you'd be surprised at how many schools and hospitals have or are building teaching kitchens. I'm still surprised. You know, this is probably one of those things that in my life has in many ways caught me by surprise. We started this project again with the support and urging of the dean, and, you know, in academic medicine, that's everything, right? Mm-hmm. The dean is the king. You know, medicine's very much like medieval England in that way.
Sure.
And so, you know, when we started and we began doing it, we got a little bit of press, maybe about 9 months or so after we had launched the programming. Pretty good press, actually. There was an article in Bon Appetit. And the phone started ringing and people started saying, you know, can we use your courseware? And we've been able to, you know, the way we wrote the courseware, the way I wrote it, and we ended up kind of crafting it was about, and you know, kind of, I ended up steering that way mostly out of self-defense. Mm-hmm. Because after it was launched, I realized that each module, there's an 8-module elective for medical students, which is how it was started. And each module has a lecture component. And so the first semester that we did the programming, there were 27 lectures in a semester to do 4 cohorts of students, because you can only do so many students at a time. At the time, we could only do 8 students. We now do 16 students in a cohort. And so I realized that if you were going to offer this to the whole medical student body at Tulane, there's 192 students, you're going to have to do 13 cohorts. Mm-hmm. And, you know, if you just did one module in a semester, that was going to be 13 lectures. And so we ended up not really out of fashion, but I ended up doing the flipped classroom model where there's online programming, online lectures, et cetera. But that's also what made it very transferable to other sites. And I think the concept of culinary medicine in our business is now very real. And, you know, I've been practicing this in my, I've been using these techniques in my practice for 20, 25 years now. And it's just been very nice to be able to take some of my knowledge base, combine it with the knowledge from the literature, as well as, you know, techniques that medical educators use in a way that really, I think, can have a significant impact on how we practice medicine. Mm-hmm.
I think this sounds really great, but can I play devil's advocate for a quick second?
I'd love for it. It's one of my favorite things.
Okay. So doctors already have so much going on, right? They all, they're dealing with medication interactions. They're dealing with patients and their social situation even. Why culinary medicine? Why is this another avenue they have to go through? Like, don't we have nutritionists for that?
Well, yes. First of all, I'll answer the last question first, because there was a lot of statement in there and some questions.
Sorry.
So the last question was, don't we already have nutritionists for that? Yes. Dietitians are an essential part of our team. You're an emergency medicine resident. Okay. When's the last time you referred a patient to a dietitian?
Never, actually. Okay. So far.
So that's that. I think you have some of my answer there. Mm-hmm. All right. So they go very much under referred, right? So physicians don't refer their patients to dietitians enough. Full stop. Mm-hmm. Problem number two is that even if I do refer my patient to a dietitian, nobody's going to pay for it. So the problem is that our system has a very narrow indication, as we say, for being able to make that referral and have it be reimbursed, all right? Mm-hmm. And those narrow definitions are generally around diabetes and only diabetes, to some extent around renal disease as well. So almost no insurance plan supports referral for obesity. Mm-hmm. In fact, if I code for obesity as the primary diagnosis in my practice, it is possible, less likely than it used to be maybe 5 years ago, but it's still very possible that I will not get reimbursed. And then the third problem is that if you're a patient who needs counseling from a dietitian, the dietitian works 9 to 5, mm-hmm. and so do you.
Right.
And so if patients can get reimbursement, they often just won't go. And I think that we, and I do believe the Academy of Nutrition and Dietetics is really working hard to help the system understand the importance of dietitians and change those reimbursement models and show how well dietitians, registered dietitians, fit into, especially fit into value-based care, a population health model. So that's your last question. The second question is, what we teach doesn't take long. I mean, and I think certainly as an ER physician, it's not necessarily your job. But as an internist, family medicine doc, cardiologist, you know, those folks who are on the front lines and seeing patients in a longitudinal fashion, because keep in mind, I see these patients, you know, every 6 weeks, every 3 months for years. I know, you know, I've had patients in my practice since I moved here mm-hmm. to New Orleans. And so you can build a relationship with a patient. And if you do, it takes no more than 2 minutes. So, Bassam, what did you have for breakfast this morning? You don't have to tell me. That's okay. What did you have what did you have for dinner last night? What did you have for lunch yesterday? What do you drink? And what do you snack on? Five things. Mm-hmm. It's literally a 45-second, maybe a 2-minute, 24-hour diet recall. It tells me a lot about you, a whole lot about you. And that dietary history for you, in my opinion, is generally speaking much more important than your family history. Mm-hmm. Okay. And then what we teach in our programming is just call and response. I mean, you know, you can do this in a few minutes. So if that patient is having, you know, an Egg McMuffin for breakfast, there's a whole host of things that they can be doing that are cheaper, that take less time, and are tastier and easy to make and better for them. It's just about us making this part of our toolbox. And, you know, you're right. I'm not going to solve my patients' dietary issues or their food habits in a single visit with them. And I think that's part of our problem as physicians, is we do want to, and we feel compelled to sometimes solve that for them, right then and there. But it's a longitudinal thing. If I can help you understand how to eat breakfast better this time and lunch the next time and dinner the next time and change the way you snack, et cetera, I can have, using Mediterranean diet principles especially, if I can move your Mediterranean diet score by 2 points, if I can improve it by 2 points, I can reduce your all-cause mortality by 25%. And I know that I can do that in 2 minutes, 3 minutes, as long as I'm doing it consistently and as long as I have the tools to be able to do it. So, we're busy. But, you know, we've known since the Leon Hart study that that folks who follow a Mediterranean diet after their first myocardial infarction have a 50 to 70% reduction in risk of their second coronary event. That's really profound. Right. I can't get that kind of numbers out of a baby aspirin or beta blockers or ACE inhibitors or statins, right? And even if I love those things. I mean, I have no problems prescribing statins, right? But even if I do prescribe those and I do the food, those two are synergistic. 1 + 1 = 2.6. So you get a lot more bang for your buck. It can be done. That's what we teach. That's what we focus on in all of our professional programming. Medicare will pay us about $19 to do smoking cessation counseling for 3 to 10 minutes. And why will they pay us for that? Because it works. Because it works, right? Because it works. And it's been shown to work. And so if you have a conversation with your patient, if you just have a conversation with them about smoking cessation, and it doesn't take much, every time you see them, they quit smoking, and they actually quit smoking at a much higher rate than you might think. So I would say that for the next week while you're working in the emergency room, for every patient that comes into your ER, non-trauma, ask yourself the following question. Is the primary reason the patient is sitting in my emergency bay gurney related to food? Because 70% of the time, those patients are in your ER because of food and because of their consumption habits. And then at the end of the week, after you've counted those patients, I want you to ask yourself, what are you doing about it?
Referring them.
Well, which is good. But I would say that the data shows short, simple messages repeated over and over. And you as an emergency room physician, as an emergency room physician who doesn't necessarily do longitudinal care, you still have an opportunity for intervention. It takes a couple of minutes for you to raise awareness in that patient and help them understand that the problems that they have are related to food. And you have to do that in a culturally sensitive way and in a way that's not offensive and one that's encouraging and supportive. Mm-hmm. And that's what we teach in our programming. I don't think that this is easy. I don't want you to sound like I think it's easy. But, you know, what we do is hard.
All right.
Just because it's hard doesn't mean we shouldn't be doing it.
And if enough people are doing it in the chain so that every healthcare provider is reminding them, it kind of becomes easier to maintain.
I think, I'm looking for the, you know, I would really like to, and we're not, you know, even in the space that I practice in, and I practice in a pretty traditional internal medicine practice, you know, I would like that practice to, you know, you should be almost inundated with positive food messaging from the moment that you hit the check-in desk to the moment you leave. Everybody should be talking about food, because it has such a profound effect on our health and improving your patient's consumption habits, irrespective of weight loss. Again, mm-hmm. irrespective of weight loss, can have just a tremendous, tremendous impact on their morbidity and mortality. So, I agree with you. This is we are busy. But part of the reason we're so busy is because we're not we may not be focused on the right thing, mm-hmm. right? If they're coming back over and over and over, because they're not changing their consumption habits and they're not eating great food, maybe we should, you know, make that part of the equation and part mm-hmm. of our toolbox. Again, right. that's what we're trying to do.
Yeah. And
so does that overcome your devil's advocacy yet?
I mean, I was already on your side, but and it's, I think it's also part of that move towards the holistic medicine side, right? That you want to care for the whole person, not just the disease.
Yeah. And it does become, you know, I also think that it's, you know, value-based delivery of care. We're giving something more necessarily than just writing prescriptions or doing interventional care. And in our defense, you know, I say this all the time, you know, for the last two millennia, we have been doing interventional and episodic care. Basam comes in, I see you, hi, how do you do? I take your blood pressure, I make a diagnosis and I write your prescription, you go away. And I don't think about you in between, right? You come back 3 months later, let me tell you what, I'm not thinking about you in that 3 month period and traditionally, because I've got other patients and I'm busy. And I think that that is shifting, where through a lot of the work that's being done across the country in more team-based care and population health management, other people are helping me think about you in between and helping me help you intervene in your care. And so I do think that the medicine that you will practice in your career will be very different than the medicine I've practiced. In that respect, the other thing to think about with food that is important is not just the quality of the calories that you're consuming and your patients are consuming, and not just the quantity, but also are they able to? So food insecurity is a social determinant of health that is pretty profound in our country. And you know, I mean, everybody quotes the statistic that, you know, 12 to 13% of people don't know where their meals are coming from in the next week. But that sounds, you know, very dramatic and sensational in a way. That 1/6 of Americans are food insecure and challenged, but it's a very real health problem for you, especially as an ER doc, because at the end of the month, if Ms. Smith runs out of money and she's diabetic and she has a choice between her insulin, purchasing her insulin, which is now ridiculously expensive, or purchasing food, she's not going hungry, right? Because we don't like to go hungry. And so there's a second issue here that we have been under-recognizing as healthcare providers, and that is that a lot of times we can talk about food with our patients, but if we're not talking to them in a way that's sensitive and helping them understand how they can get access to food, that's probably just as important. And it's probably especially important in that 13% of the population, because many of those folks are maybe more vulnerable from the standpoint of their health to begin with. So food should be, I mean, I think every, you know, my position has become that, you know, and certainly this has, you know, changed dramatically for me in the last few years as part of the work with the Health Meets Food Project. Every hospital and every medical school should have a food policy. I think every university should have a food policy. I think there should be a dean of food at every university and every med school. You know, someone who is thinking about this, because it just has such a profound effect on people's lives and lifestyle.
Right, pretty much everything we do. So kind of connected to that, so there's a bunch of studies out here that say, 34% of physicians are overweight. At least 10% of physicians define themselves as obese.
I think we're human, right? As physicians, and no one's necessarily taught us either how to do this. A lot of us are overweight, and some of us are obese, and I don't know what those statistics are. But I think that part of the goal of the Health Meets Food Project is that we are showing physicians how to walk the walk, because there is pretty good data that says if you walk the walk yourself and you talk the talk about the walk that you walk and you share that with your patients and you are an example for them, that they will listen to you at an even higher rate. And again, they do listen to us. I know most of us don't think they do. You know, I'm assuming that, you know, this podcast is going out to mostly, healthcare providers, medical students, et cetera. And I think most of us think that our patients don't listen to us, but they do. And when you share with them, hey, here's how I do it. I bring a sandwich every day, and here's what my sandwich looks like, or here's how I exercise, here's how I do my planning, and here's some resources to do that. And you can do those things in 2 minutes or less, 3 minutes or less. It can be done. Mm-hmm. They listen to you at a pretty high rate. So, I think building healthier physicians is just as important a mission in this now. And it was one of those that was really, as we say here in New Orleans, lanyap. It was a bonus. You know, it was something that has come along with the project.
Really quick, just your thoughts on this. I mean, other than read your book, a lot of times residents are kind of working super long hours on minimal sleep. What can they do to ensure that they're just not, you know, getting pizza from the hospital cafeteria or kind of hurting themselves in the long run based on with their food choices?
Well, again, I would say, you know, that's just a planning issue. If you just take your meals with you, and a lot of residents do. I don't think universally, I talk to medical students and residents all the time, and they, you know, they are doing this, but the more you do that and the more that you as a resident, or a medical student, which is a very challenging time because your schedule is not your own. It's a little bit more your own maybe when you're in practice. But just doing that planning, saying to yourself, you know, I'm going to be on call, you know, next Tuesday. What am I going to have for dinner? And the other piece of this that's critical is, when am I going to exercise? And how am I going to do that, and where? And that's a commitment also. And I think maybe certainly almost is, if not more important than the food itself. I think, you know, exercise is a critical piece. I travel a lot these days. People invite me to come speak, and I do some traveling for my day job. As associate dean in the medical director work that I do. And, you know, I used to say, oh, I'm traveling, I can't exercise. And I don't travel now without my bike shorts and a t-shirt and some shoes. And I go to the gym and I ride the bike for an hour. And I think you just have to say, where am I going to be? And how am I going to fuel myself and eat really great food? And embracing that. And by really great food, I don't mean just healthy food. I mean, you know, really great food, stuff that you crave, that you love to eat. And so as a resident, you know, making, on Sunday or Thursday, depending on when your off day is, making yourself, you know, a big pot of chili or some lasagna or You know, even something as simple as tuna noodle casserole, you know, whatever floats your boat, but making enough of it, it takes, you know, maybe it might take you 30 minutes or an hour, save you a lot of money. You know, all the recipes, culinarymedicine.org, which is the Health Meets Food Project, you know, and most of the recipes at drgourmet.com, they're pretty inexpensive. You know, we're very, very sensitive to cost as well for some of the reasons that we talked about earlier with the food insecurity issue. So it's just, you know, it just goes back to the planning thing. And if you are going to eat out, make that decision, make that as part of your planning, you know, and know you're going to, you know, you're not just going to end up eating at Subway, you know, which is, you know, really bad for you. You know, the nitrites in that processed meat and the white bread, I mean, yeah, they've got some fresh ingredients, but you know, those nitrites are, I mean, that turkey sub is carcinogenic. You know, make no mistake, the nitrites in that are quite carcinogenic. And so, you know, just making those decisions for yourself far enough in advance. And a lot of hospitals, you know, have great cafeterias now. I mean, really healthy choices. And it's about saying to yourself and embracing that, I'm going to go and I'm going to, you know, I'm going to get this or that, the thing that I love on the menu that, you know, is pretty healthy. And I'm going to do it at such and such a time and really try and plan that out as much as possible. I think that's the best answer I've got.
Right. What books have made the biggest impact on your life?
What books have made the biggest impact on my life? Certainly from a cookbook standpoint, James Beard's The Theory and Practice of Good Cooking. It's not in print anymore, but you can buy it pretty easily on eBay, and it is absolutely worth buying and reading. It has a great approach to teaching people the techniques of how to cook. It's just a fantastic book. I will say probably one of the things that influences me maybe more than anything else is I read The New Yorker every week, yes, cover to cover. And granted, I'm a liberal, and happy about that, but you know, it just, you know, The New Yorker, especially under David Remnick, as editor, in chief previously, you know, the previous editor, maybe not so great. There was a period of time where not quite so good, but it's just the, you know, for a century now, that magazine has you know, is fun, funny, educational, topical, thoughtful, in-depth, even though I'm a liberal, less biased than people would, you know, than maybe conservatives would think. It's just a great publication. And everybody should have The New Yorker on their iPhone. And read it every week, because I think it's just one of those terrific things. Probably the other big influence is has been the Guardian newspaper, the London newspaper. I will say that there is a terrific book that I read recently that I just thought was incredibly delightful, called A Gentleman in Moscow. It's definitely worth a read. It's a very quiet, thoughtful, soft book about Moscow from Bolshevik Revolution onward. Okay. It's a work of fiction.
Cool. And I do agree with you about The New Yorker. That's one of those things I try to tell people. If you want to learn how to write, that's something you should read.
That's a good point. And you know, I know a few New Yorker writers, and boy, and I will say for those of you out there, for the residents, physicians who are listening to this, Atul Gawande wrote an article about medicine, about incrementalism. You should, and how primary care physicians are the true heroes of medicine. It's definitely, I think all of his articles from are great, not just for us as healthcare providers, because they do offer us some insights into worlds that we may not otherwise see in our own industry. But also, I think he just writes for the lay public really, really well.
If you could have dinner with anyone in the world, who would it be and why?
Living or dead?
Either. Whichever one you want.
Either. Oh, Thomas Jefferson.
Thomas Jefferson. Why?
I think a lot of different reasons. You know, there's all this controversy today about fake news and you know, crazy people in politics, et cetera. You know, we have a long storied tradition in America of this behavior. I mean, you know, what the Republicans and Democrats are doing right now is nothing new. I mean, our quote founding fathers, you know, they would write these long screeds, you know, and publish them. and they just lie about each other. I mean, they really did. So this concept of fake news, you know, this is nothing new. It's just a different medium. And I think, you know, because he was sort of an accidental hero, if you will, you know, a whole host of reasons. He was a gourmand. He was a wine grower. He lived in Paris, you know, at a time. He was cosmopolitan, yet he was a farmer and really in many ways an anarchist, mm-hmm. not so much a Republican in the truest sense of what a Republican meant at the time, as opposed to being a Federalist, because, you know, Federalists are really now Republicans. I just, you know, his interactions, you know, with all of the people at the time who, you know, created a really, it was just a really interesting moment in history. And he sat in many ways at the center of that. You know, he was Secretary of State. He was ambassador to France. He just did everything. And he basically died broke. Which is awesome. He was an architect, a builder. I mean, if you've never been to Monticello, you know, they made their own bricks. I mean, a real people use the term Renaissance man. I'm not even sure that that's appropriate. He just did it all. Mm-hmm. And died broke, which is really brilliant. Mm-hmm. I mean, just actually died in debt, a lot in debt, like $86,000 mm-hmm. or so, you know, millions of dollars in debt, which is just brilliant. You know, you just and at the same time, you know, while it was the Moors of the time, and I think he was against it, you know, he was a slave owner. And, mm-hmm. you know, I'd love to, you know, why? Why did you not change this? Mm-hmm. And didn't. Unlike Washington, didn't free his slaves in his will. And so just a really complex individual who probably had more impact on our society today than any single person I could think of.
Interesting.
And I'm not, and I don't want to sound like I'm necessarily a big Thomas Jefferson fan, mm-hmm. because some ways, you know, I think a lot of what he did was not great. Right. But you know, if you want to sit down and have dinner, the food would be great. I have no doubt the guy would set a great table.
Yes. All right. And then last question. If you could choose your last meal, what would it be?
It would be beef, actually, which, you know, is probably, you know, anathema to people who, you know, think you should be eating healthy. And I think, you know, certainly a nice little unsuspecting piece of well pastured grass fed beef is healthy and can be a health part of our diet. So, you know, anybody who wants to criticize that as a choice, one of my very best friends died this year, and he's a chef. His name was John Pearson, and it would be one of John's steaks. The man could flat cook a steak, and he did this. He made the best veal stock in the world, and he did this really fantastic grilled tenderloin, you know, true grill with a caramelized shallot sauce that was just to die for. Yeah. So it'd be one of John Pearson's meals.
Sounds delicious. Thanks really for
it. No, it was great to meet you.
Yeah, great to meet you too. And I mean, I really appreciate you sharing all this stuff. And I still have so many more questions for you for a later time. Everything from, you know, the link between obesity and technology and portion sizes. And
I'm happy to get, you know, happy to get back together anytime. Cool. I can prattle on, obviously, for a while.
Yeah.
Thank Great you to meet much. You, man.
Yeah, you too.
The famed chef Julia Child once said, "If you're in a good profession, it's hard to get bored because you're never finished. There will always be work you haven't yet done." In medicine, our work is far from over. There are always new ways to learn, to heal, to teach, and to create. So what new project have you been hoping to start? And what have you been procrastinating on? Now ask yourself, if not now, then when?
For more information about Dr. Hustle, to view today's show notes, or to contact Bassam, visit drhustle.com. If you want others to know about this podcast, please write a review at the podcast store, and please link to us on social media at dr_hustle on Twitter and at dr.hustle on Instagram. This podcast is produced by Bassam Zahid, whose other work can be found at bassamzahid.com. Thanks for listening.